Barbara and I, along with our firstborn, Kimberly, who was not quite 3 years of age, were visiting my parents in their home. Grandma's and Grandpa's house was not as kid-proof as our own, and so there were vases and books and other ornaments decoratively placed around the room. Kim had been in the house several times before and knew that there were certain things she was not supposed to touch or play with. But in spite of that past education, it seems that this day a particular vase caught her attention, and she walked over to it and picked it up and began to walk away with it. I went to her and I reminded her that this vase was not to be touched, and I put it back and I diverted her attention with a toy. I decided not to move the vase out of her reach, though we had done that with other things in our own home. I didn't feel it was appropriate in someone else's home. Plus, I wanted Kim to learn that no meant no. I truly thought that was the end of the matter until I saw her a little later eyeing the vase from across the room, and then she began to inch her way around the edge of the room until she was standing by that vase. She looked at the vase, and then she looked at me, and she looked at the vase, and she looked at me again, and then with what I could only describe as a defiant look, looking squarely at me, her hand reaches out, laid hold of that vase, brought it in, and as deliberately as anyone could, looked me squarely in the eyes and walked off with that vase. What is a father to do at such a time? Well, I think what you're supposed to do is summon up all of the leadership that you have and call your wife. We laugh, I think, mostly because it is such a common experience. I know I've told that story before, but I tell it again because it so classically illustrates so many issues of parenting. At that moment, the issue of authority was going on. How could that little, as one friend of mine refers to children, that little sample person so openly defy authority? There was the issue of embarrassment for me as a father. How could I have a child who would so openly disobey with my parents sitting there, nonetheless? How would I, their son, respond? And certainly there was the issue of obedience, a teachable moment. It seemed to me that everything was on the line. What was I to do? How was a father supposed to act? Well, this is Father's Day, 1994, and it so happens by the providence of God that we have come in our study of Colossians chapter 3 to the 21st verse. I invite you to open your Bible, please, to that passage and look at it with me. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 21, Paul addresses his remarks to fathers. In other words, how is a father to act in relationship to his children now that he is a Christian? You probably will remember, because we have repeated it for a couple of weeks, that at the beginning of the third chapter, the Apostle Paul wrote that believers would now live their lives differently because they belong to Jesus Christ. In verse 8, specifically, the Apostle Paul said there are certain things that we must be done away with. We must put off anger and rage and slander and so on. You'll notice verse 12, you will see that he says, instead, I want you to clothe yourselves with compassion and kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. As I've mentioned the last 2 weeks, what the Apostle Paul is doing in verses 18 and following is he is following up on or making practical application of the first half of the chapter. Knowing and loving Jesus Christ is to make a difference in our relationships. Verses 18 and 19, it's to make a difference in the relationship of marriage. 2 weeks ago, we looked at that. Last week, we looked at verses 22 to 25, and we saw that knowing Jesus Christ and loving Him makes a difference in our relationships at work. Today, we look at how the life of a father is changed because of his relationship to Jesus. If you'll notice verse 20, I want to say that I am specifically not addressing that verse today. Verse 20 will be addressed later on, because the associate pastors of our church are going to, beginning on the 4th of July weekend, start a series of the Ten Commandments. And the fifth commandment deals with the same issue as you have here in verse 20, and the subject will be dealt with at that time. Today, looking at verse 21 then, I want to deal specifically with the relationship of a father to his children. It doesn't take an investigative reporter to see that there's a difference in kids and a difference in homes. It seems that almost anywhere we go, we can see the effects of poor parenting. You see it every time you pick up a newspaper. You see it when you go into a grocery store. You see it, it seems, when any group of people are gathered together with their children. And young fathers today see the effects of poor parenting around them as well, and they want to do it differently. They are saying, God help me, how do I raise these kids? Now, I'm very glad for that question, because for too long, I'm convinced very few people were asking it, or at least they were waiting to ask it until their children neared adolescence. What is the counsel of the Lord on rearing our children? First of all, from verse 21, I ask you a question. Who is God addressing in this text? Through the Apostle Paul, who is God specifically addressing? Fathers. Look, please, again at verse 20, where Paul tells children to obey their parents. Notice that word parents is a word that includes both mothers and fathers. But when he comes to verse 21, the Apostle Paul uses a different word. The word is fathers. Why a different word? Now, first of all, I think it would be pressing the point way too far to suggest that in verse 21, the Apostle Paul is in no way addressing mothers, or that the principle involved in verse 21 does not apply to mothers. That is not the case. But I think the remarks are addressed particularly to fathers because the culture in which this was first written, as in our culture, fathers tend to one of two extremes. Either they are autocratic or they are uninvolved. In the contemporary Roman culture, fathers had unlimited power and authority over their children. Not only the Roman, but also the Greek and Jewish cultures, the cultures that influenced these people, allowed severe punishment for disobedient children. I believe it is a principle of God's word and human living that with more authority comes more responsibility. It is true in government, it is true in industry, it is true everywhere in all relationships of life, meaning it is also true in the home. If men are going to be leaders in their homes, which is what I believe the Bible teaches, then they bear primary responsibility. And so Paul addresses himself to fathers most of all. And what is the instruction? Verse 21. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Now, I know, and you know, that this isn't all that God says about Christian child rearing in the Scriptures. Then isn't it interesting that of all Paul could have said to these Colossian Christians, he chose to say this? Why? Notice the positive instruction to each group prior to this. If you look back at verse 18, you will see it says, wives, submit to your husbands. Verse 19, husbands, love your wives. Verse 20, children, obey your parents. Let's skip ahead to what we looked at last week. Verse 22, slaves, obey your earthly masters. Chapter 4, verse 1, masters, provide what is fair and just. Now look at verse 21. Fathers, do not embitter your children. Has the Apostle Paul touched on a tendency among fathers that was too true then and too true today? I know a dad, not of this church, who unfortunately illustrates a father who I believe is embittering his children. His discipline is often capricious and often excessive. On one occasion, he will completely overlook certain behavior, and on the next occasion, he will erupt in violence. He loses control of himself, it seems. He's unreasonable, he's unfair, he's unkind, and I have watched his children through the years, and I sense in them a smoldering hostility. Haven't you met children like that? When you get to know them, they are like volcanoes waiting to erupt. There is a sullenness about them that is absolutely eerie, and the closer you get to the situation, the more convinced you are that it's only a matter of time before that anger erupts. Now, Paul's instruction then seems so appropriate. Don't embitter your children. Now, that word embitter can be translated provoke. That is, don't provoke your children. Now, the word means to stir up. Paul, writing to the Ephesian Christians, said something very similar when he said, fathers, don't exasperate your children. Don't stir them up. Don't arouse them to anger. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that fathers never do anything to which their children might respond angrily. Children may become angry, but the instruction to fathers is, don't give them reason to be angry. Key word is reason. For you see, a child's own sinfulness may give rise to his or her anger in response to your actions. The instruction here is, may it not be your sinfulness, Father, which gives rise to their anger. To embitter is to increase the intensity of the feelings. Little by little through the years, the child grows frustrated because of the embittering activities and attitudes of the father until finally the child is discouraged and angry. Ounce by ounce, the provocations add up until there's a heavy weight on the child, but finally the child throws off in rebellion, but frankly never throws completely off. Now, before going on to discuss how it is that we can avoid embittering our children, I want to address for a couple of moments the issue of discipline. It might be tempting if we looked just at verse 21 to get the impression that Paul was promoting permissiveness, as if he were saying, fathers, make certain you never cross your children. Don't embitter them, lest you discourage them. Of course, that's not what the Apostle Paul is teaching. On the authority of other passages of Scripture, we know that there is a major assumption unstated in Colossians 3, but nonetheless implied. For in the parallel passage, Ephesians chapter 6, and I'd like for you to turn to it, please, we find the Apostle Paul dealing with the same issue as he does in Colossians 3, but he adds something that I think is implied in Colossians 3. So Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, we read, fathers, don't exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Now that word training is a word with which we are quite familiar, for it's a word that is otherwise translated discipline. Remember Hebrews 12? The Lord disciplines those he loves. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, then you are not true sons. Now, the concept of training in this Ephesians 6, 4 passage is the same issue as discipline. If a father is planning to bring up his children, if a father is planning to nurture his children, he must not overlook discipline. Now, unfortunately, that word discipline conjures up many negative images in our minds because there are some parents who, in the name of discipline, have abused their children. There are some parents who, in the name of discipline, have themselves been abused by their parents. I hate abuse. I know of nothing in life that I detest more than child abuse. When I see it or when I read of it, something happens inside of me, and I know it happens inside of many of you. I hate abuse, but I love discipline. For discipline is not negative when I see how God uses it. And in this Ephesians passage, it is obvious that discipline is a part of nurturing. It is a part of bringing children up. And when this word discipline is used in the New Testament, it has about it the idea of helping someone learn how to act, helping someone learn how to set limits, helping someone learn how to become self-disciplined. My daughter Stephanie told us a couple of years ago of a visiting professor in her college who said that a parent should never curb a child's expressions of their emotions. And so that you do not repress your children, you must allow them unbridled expression of their feelings. Now, there's some wisdom in what that professor said, for it ought to be true that our children know how to express and are able to express their feelings. But what was said was later the explicit statement, and herein the implied statement, that you should never train or discipline the child in the productive expressions of their feelings. Someone wrote, surely with 1 and 2-year-olds in mind, at any time the world is only 20 years away from anarchy. Unless someone cares enough to teach self-discipline. In every area of life, children need someone there to guide them, to show them the limits, to keep them from hurting themselves until they learn enough self-discipline to go it alone. Children operate under the misguided notion that goes something like this, if you love me, you'll want me to be happy. But a wise parent knows that there are many things in life that will bring you temporary happiness, but a lifetime of sorrow. Now, Thomas Howard says it well when he uses the illustration of a child who wanted another candy bar. Now, the child's thinking goes something like this. If one candy bar tastes good and makes me happy, then another candy bar will make me happier. And if you say no to the child says, why not? You're being cruel. You don't like me. You want me to be unhappy. You hate me. Now, how do you argue with that? It has all of the apparent evidence on its side. Candy bars do taste good, and the last one did make the child happy. And if we love the child and want him to be happy, surely we will give him another candy bar. The logic is so apparently good, but so absolutely wrong. And we've been there. We know that too many candy bars will make him sick, and we love him. We don't want him to be sick or to become a pig, and so we forbid him this pleasure. Now, how do I possibly explain to my child that this cruelty on my part is actually boosting him along directly towards a freedom and a power that he cannot even imagine right now? The freedom and power to desire and choose authentic happiness. For left to himself in his lack of self-discipline, he will not only ruin his appetite, he will ruin his life and his eternity. And you say, wait a minute, surely a candy bar can't ruin him. Or can it? The child says, if you love me, you'll want me to be happy. The godly parent, operating under a very different notion, says, because I love you, I want you to be good. Because goodness will not only yield temporary happiness, but a lifetime of joy. The word no, along with the authority and discipline to back it up, is a saving word. You are saving a child from an undisciplined self. A child doesn't know that there's a lot he doesn't know. And for his sake, he must have an outside authoritative voice or he will ruin himself. And by that outside authoritative parent who loves him to give him enough discipline, he will then learn how to submit himself to the authority. And it will be well with his soul when he reads and obeys, thus saith the Lord. Do you love your child? And Father, you will discipline him or her. Now I'm back to the Colossian passage, and I say, I believe the assumption that is being made in this Colossians text is that fathers will discipline their children. Paul doesn't say that here in the text. He doesn't add that comment. What this text is dealing with is the question of how to discipline without embittering your children. I'd like to note for you several attitudes and actions that I believe we can have and take that will avoid embittering our children. And I believe that what I'm going to suggest to you are implications of this command, fathers, do not embitter your children or they will become discouraged. First of all, Dad, be generous, not selfish. How many times in our own selfishness, in irritability, do we wind up lashing out at our own children? Kent Hughes tells of a cartoon where a father came home from work grouchy because his boss had treated him unfairly. The dad acted irritably toward his son. The son turned around, now irritated, and kicked the dog. The dog ran out of the house, down the street, and bit the first man he saw who happened to be the man's boss. Dads, how often are our actions toward our children governed by our irritability, by our discomfort? We are in a bad mood. And our children have to be careful. How often do our demands on our children flow out of not their good, but out of our own selfish desires? I've been around fathers who I'm convinced must think that their children are there for them. And it does not take a child long at all to figure out that a father's petty demands are rooted in selfishness, not in generosity. I think it's reasonable to ask, is this request, this demand or this discipline of my child genuinely for the sake of my child, or is it truly only for my sake? Dad, be generous, not selfish. Selfish demands and selfish discipline lead to bitterness and discouragement. Secondly, I'd say, Dad, be kind. Don't embarrass your children. Certainly a child will become embittered if we repeatedly attack his or her personhood. 2-year-old Jim's, the son of one of our pastors, Jim Kimbrell, was walking across the floor of our home, and he stumbled. And being a 2-year-old, the way that the stumbling came about and the way that he actually stumbled and what happened as a result of it was cute. And we laughed. But the instant embarrassment that he experienced made us realize again how vulnerable a child is and how careful we must be not to do what impacts them, him or her, as ridicule. Now, our embarrassment of Jim's was accidental. But how many fathers use ridicule and embarrassment as a means of punishment? Or worse yet, as a means of just plain meanness? And humiliation breeds hostility. It does not breed self-discipline. And a child can tell the difference between harshness, between meanness, and fairness. Be kind. I think it's imperative that we consider the feelings of the child, feelings that probably have nothing to do with the discipline that we are giving or the demands that we are making. All discipline and correction of children should be done as privately as possible. Fathers, that we would be kind and not embarrass, for I believe embarrassment will lead to embitterment. Thirdly, Dad, we must be consistent, not capricious. How sad it is for a child to live in fear, not knowing what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior, especially when the same action will on one occasion bring praise and the next occasion bring violence. If an action is okay today, it ought to be okay tomorrow. If it's wrong today, it ought to be wrong tomorrow. Consistency. I've been a father for over 27 years. When you add up the ages of each of my daughters, I have 75 years of fathering experience. And among other things, one of the things that this experience has taught me about fathering is that consistency is difficult. Very difficult. In fact, do you know what it requires? It requires self-discipline. Consistency requires self-discipline. It means that we, fathers, will know what is right and wrong. It means that we, fathers, will live by those rules ourselves. It is that we, fathers, will patiently hold our children to those standards. Dads, be consistent, not capricious. Fourthly, Dad, be reasonable, not harsh. Pastor Gordon MacDonald tells of being at the beach one hot summer day, and he said, "I shivered at the implications of what I saw happen there. An 8-year-old boy was getting a bit too enthusiastic with a group of 5-year-olds in the water. He didn't know his own strength, and what had started out as fun soon got out of control. Moments passed, and some of the parents of the younger children were getting uneasy, and they looked at the father of the older boy, wishing that he would do something. That father, however, ignored what was taking place until all of a sudden, with a booming voice, he yells out, 'Robert, get out of that water this instant. Blast it, Robert, I'm getting sick and tired of the way you're acting. Look at what you've done. Get your hands off those kids.' The child very nervously looks about to see what other children or adults may be looking at him, and he offers a whimpering response. 'But Daddy, don't talk back to me,' the father says more loudly than ever. 'Don't you argue with me. I saw what you were doing, and I'm disgusted with you. Now I want you to sit up there in the sand until we go, and I want you to think about what's going to happen to you when you get home.' At that point, the father sat back down among his friends as if nothing had happened. Gordon MacDonald writes, something had happened. A child was crushed. Getting grounded for a month for missing a deadline by 5 minutes is not fair. Getting a spanking for the first time a child tries out a 4-letter word at home is not reasonable. And all children have a built-in sense of fairness and justice, and if you violate that continually, you will embitter your children. Dads, we must be fair, reasonable, not harsh. Fifthly, Dad, we must be forgiving rather than constantly critical. I happen to believe that it's right for people to strive for excellence. I happen to believe that it is right for parents to help their children do the very best they can do. But you know as well as I do that each age, each level of maturity, and each person has a competency of its or his or her own. And to force our level of perfection on a child is to discourage them. One of the most indicting things I have ever heard come from the lips of my own children when they were younger were these words said to their mother, "I can't ever seem to get it right for him." You know what that's like? Our children can be embittered when we continually denigrate their efforts, when in their eyes, they never measure up to our expectations. Dad, be forgiving rather than constantly critical. Lastly, Dad, I would call on you as well as me to be loving rather than aloof or distant. Boswell, the famous biographer of Samuel Johnson, often spoke of a day that he went fishing with his father. Many years later, someone wanted to see what Boswell's father thought of that day, for he too had kept a journal. Of that day, the elder Boswell wrote, "Gone fishing today with my son. A day wasted." What a sad commentary on a man's understanding of fatherhood. In a magazine entitled 17, one girl in an article lamented that her father was not making contact with her, though he was physically there. She wrote these words, "Have you ever heard of a father who won't talk to his daughter? My father doesn't seem to know I'm alive. In my whole life, he has never said he loves me or given me a goodnight kiss unless I asked him. I think the reason he ignores me is because I'm boring. I look at my friends and think, if I were funny like Jill or a super brain like Sandy or even outrageous and punk like Tasha, he'd put down his paper and be fascinated with me. I play the recorder, and for the past 3 years, I've been a soloist in the fall concert at school. Mom comes to the concerts, but Dad never does. This year, I'm a senior, so it's his last chance. I'd give anything to look out into the audience and see him there. But who's kidding? It'll never happen. I'm afraid that selfish aloofness is a disease to which the modern father is very, very susceptible." I love the line from Elliot Daly when he said of himself, "Incredible. I mean, what have I done in my whole life that was of any more significance than fathering three human beings? Once they were not, they didn't exist. Now they live. They are worthy of the investment of my life. Dad, be there. Not aloof, not distant." In the scriptures, God calls us fathers to nurture our children, to train them and instruct them, to guide them and prepare them for life. And in the midst of that instruction, God wisely adds this word to us: "Fathers, do not embitter your children, for they will become discouraged. Be generous, not selfish. Be kind, don't embarrass. Be consistent, not capricious. Reasonable, not harsh. Forgiving, not critical. Loving, not distant." Before I close, let me add a word to all of us who know that we have blown it on occasion. And maybe there are some here who, because your children are older or because of their actions, you wonder if you have blown it completely. I am so thankful for the grace of God. I am so grateful that every day is a new beginning by His grace. And I am so thankful that the grace of God extends to the point of changing relationships even when they've been damaged. And I think I can say that I can almost guarantee that, Father, if you will change now, yes, it may take 5 or 10 years, but I believe that your children will eventually respond to your love. And the embitterment and the bitterness and so forth that may have grown up as a result of some of your attitudes or actions, that can not only be forgiven but overcome. The grace of God is that today is a new beginning. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Would you stand with me, please, as we close in prayer?